Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about 8 trends that will reshape the FinTech landscape, 4 trends in self-directed retirement accounts, the SEC creates a Fin Hub, and the success rate of blockchain implementations. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, well, welcome to the FinTech Newscast. With me this week is Monica.
Hey, John.
And Steve.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
All right. Let's get started with what's going to happen as we enter the end of 2018 into next year and into the future. Now, this week in Business World talks about 8 trends that they think will reshape the FinTech landscape. And some are kind of on the spot, and some are kind of buzzwordy. I'll let you guys here help me decide which ones are which. Okay, first one, intelligent banking channels. This sounds
what,
a little...
What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so what they're saying is that they're going to customize and tailor fit each way that you interact with your financial institution to your specific needs. So maybe the voice will be a certain way. This is... I'm interpreting a lot because it doesn't give a whole lot of detail. Maybe because they didn't know what they meant either. they're talking about, it sounds like personalization.
Yeah, and I think, you know, banks already do this too. Like if you log in online and your typical behavior is to pay bills online, that's often like one of the first things that you'll see. I also feel like banks have been doing forever. They're going to use these personalization options to sell you things that you may not want. For example, for one of the banks that I log into, oh my God, every time it's this huge screen of something they want to offer me, or especially, do I want more information?
Yeah.
And I do not. And I'm very glad that I can say no thanks, not remind me later, but no thanks, but there's always another one the next time.
Well, so, you know what? That's a trend that's going to be more in 2019,
I'm
according
expecting
to
it.
Business World.
I'm expecting it. Not welcoming it, but expecting it.
I wonder if they use the same algorithm as Amazon, where if you buy a washing machine from Amazon, it'll feed you more washing machines. I wonder whether if you get a credit card from your bank,
right?
You'd be like, hey, you got a credit
for
card.
Your second or third washing machine.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. In case you need it.
Shouldn't they switch to detergent or something, right?
Exactly, yeah.
All right.
It kind of speaks to how smart you really want your intelligence to be.
Right. Well, there you go. All right, number 2 on the list is multi-experience banking. So this one, they're talking about all the different ways they can reach you and some of the new things like voice assistants or smart speakers, on your augmented reality, virtual reality. Now, that sounds a little buzzwordy, hypey. I don't see like...
It sounds hypey 3 or 4 years ago, AR, VR. I feel like it's sort of... taken a nosedive in the past at least a year and a half.
It's reshaping the landscape every year for the next few years. Yeah, there's not been a wide... It's kind of like AR, VR has kind of dropped off a bit, I feel like. Even with things coming out like the Oculus Go, it's only $199. We don't get any money back for promoting that, but...
I don't know. I mean, maybe just right now in this moment, I'm having a hard time coming up with... the ways that I would be interested to see AR in particular be used in the financial sector. But you can see some places where things that are deeply connected to big financial transactions might come into play. So AR, I think, is really interesting in terms of like the house buying process. So if you didn't have to go to every open house, what if you could use virtual reality, for example, to kind of tour a place to see if you actually want to go see it in person? Or augmented reality to see what your bathroom might look like after you remodel it. After you take out your home equity line, whatever it is. So, you know, I'm not sure.
If there's augmented reality that shows my bathroom clean, that would be pretty cool.
Then you just want to like put those lenses over your eyes forever.
I have that built in on my own. But.
So, you know, I'm interested to see how some of these things might connect to the financial world. And I'm sure there are people more creative than me.
So, and then integrating that experience. So you're getting that same washing machine ad everywhere you go, Monica.
I'm not in the market for a washing machine, thanks.
All right. Okay, so the next trend that they mentioned is voice-assisted banking. So this is a focus on things like, the virtual assistants, and also things like understanding, so natural language processing.
This is one that I'm really skeptical about, because I happen to have some experience with larger banks, and I know that it's very difficult for a user to be authenticated via voice match with a virtual assistant. So if you ask Alexa, what's my balance or whatever, that's fine. But once you get into sort of that second layer of request, like send money, pay this bill, whatever, it's kind of hard to match your voice to the command that you're asking of the bank. And banks, of course, have a higher level of authentication needs than, say, a Google or Amazon. So I understand that, you know, the convenience of like giving my balance or do kind of basic banking tasks through your voicing. But I think that the authentication is an issue. And also, if you look at the traditional bank infrastructure, a lot of their servers are, their stuff is all on-prem, it's all on-premise. And all this Alexa, Google Home type stuff, it's all on the cloud. And banks have been really quite slow in adopting any cloud-based services.
Can you imagine authenticating through Alexa? What's your password? It's 815628.
Well, I think we are making an assumption that all of this integration will be done through a Google Home or an Alexa or any kind of smart speaker. That doesn't necessarily have to be the case. You could call up your bank, and if you had a really sophisticated natural language processor on the other end, instead of having to go through the phone tree, what's my PIN and what's this, that, and the other, you could just call those things out. Like, I mean, don't we all love to just kind of do other things while we're on speakerphone? Like,
it's true. And I've read somewhere that apparently most Americans, which is, of course, kind of an obvious fact, most Americans nowadays commute by themselves in the car. And of people who do that, maybe like half or so interact with their voice assistants, either Siri, Google, or Alexa, while on the go. So now banks are looking to potentially, how do they insert themselves in that process, right? How do they actually, how can this serve customers better who may be commuting or doing sort of voice-enabled tasks on their way to work? So it could happen at some point, but I think that where we are now, it's difficult to authenticate users, and kind of the experience is just not quite there. So maybe this could be a trend for 2020 or 2021.
I think we'll see
so.
This similar list for 2023.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Voice enabled banking, the wave of the future.
In 2023. It always will be. That's right. So the next trend, number four, is narrow AI in banking. And this is one that I think is one of the more practical ones on this list. Applying AI to a focused task. So operational kind of, back office kind of things. Mm-hmm. So scanning and reading applications or forms or a specifically focused AI on maybe customer service, that type of thing. And that seems like the kind of thing that's already saving a lot of money for back-end operations.
Yeah, and something that because it's narrow, because the scope is tight, because it may not always require in-person customer actions, you can kind of build it and run with it and really get some savings off of it without necessarily needing the best natural language processing system on the market.
Yeah. No, automating repetitive tasks is, that should be a red flag when you're
great
looking around
business,
your organization. Right?
Great for your employees.
Yeah, for sure.
I also think that the more boring the task, the more likely that it'll be implemented next year. So, this makes sense as a use case that could actually bear some fruit in 2019. The others I'm kind of unsure about.
All right. Number five trend is the rise of open banking. Now, we know that in Europe, there's some regulations around connectivity between financial institutions. But and actually, Steve, what do you think, since you look at these kind of implementations, like could an app kind of just consolidate all of your financial institutions, all your services, so you could have like a Bank of America along with some smaller things all in one app, and it's all connected? Do you have to have this regulation to do that?
You don't have to. So if you remember from maybe 10 years ago, Mint was really popular in the U.S. and there were data aggregators.
So yeah, why is that 10 years ago? Why is there not something now?
So I think there's sort of this is a longer discussion, but there's a different framework. I think that in the UK and the EU, you have things like GDPR and PSD2 the Payment Service Directive number 2, the sequel, which actually sort of forced banks to share this data and really embrace open banking in a more API-based world. In the US, there's been no such regulatory move to do so, so the banks have sort of have to do it on their own. So there's some movement now around banks sort of creating, unbundling their services and creating APIs so they can surface their products to customers wherever they may be. I just think that it'll be more slowly adopted in the US. I think that it's definitely going to happen.
So there's nothing standing in the way.
No, it's. I think the main challenge is basically the infrastructure and having the banks be able to play in the cloud and allow their services to be surfaced across multiple, you know, channels.
Because if you just type in your ID and password, I see with apps, you can just allow that interaction, right?
Yeah, and that's oftentimes based on either granting an API access or doing what they call screen scraping, which is they just copy your password and your username and just look at the data that's on the screen and then servicing through a different service.
So unless the bank allows an API connection, it'll be that kind of more kludgy screen scraping.
Correct, yeah.
And that, and all of that is not the same thing as, well, actually what I want to do is transfer money from Bank of America account to my Charles Schwab account, but I haven't previously linked them in some bank-to-bank specific way. So like what Mint is doing is just kind of showing you relatively real-time data. It's not the same thing as being able to move money, kind of cross transfer or interact between these different entities.
Right, right. Or even
because when you set up your like a Venmo account, don't you use your bank ID and password, and then they can connect back and forth.
You can, yeah.
Is that
you
how
do.
It works?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. But that,
so
that,
can
that's
can
just
they
an
do
API.
Use it for other? Like connect like your mortgage is somewhere else and then make the payment.
Yeah,
or...
and that's easy. There are a thousand apps you can get now that could kind of aggregate your whole financial picture, and that's fine. I think that what the PSD2 and the UK is doing is a little deeper. It's actually looking at
more security.
Yeah, so it's basically can I make a payment with my checking account without having my checking account all myself? Can I use this other portal to make a payment and those kind of things? And also, can I easily port my money from say B of A to Citibank without having to actually open up a Citibank account? So it's a little deeper level of integration that we haven't seen in the US yet.
So maybe it's a good idea if we put some kind of minimum bar security and regulation around it, just to have some standards as to when that does happen, it should be X level of security, X level of interaction, because it's going to happen anyway.
I think so, and I think that it's maybe the case sort of along the lines of GDPR, which is now live in Europe, and we see sort of a similar law in California potentially next year or this year. Is it next year?
I think it's
2020.
I thought so.
Right, so I think that there's kind of a slow movement toward that. So I think that like in data privacy, the EU is leading the way for open banking for the US. So, you know, maybe this is a trend that I actually see happening sometime in 2019, 2020. So
the EU leading the way since 220 BC.
Right.
All right. Okay, number 6 on our fintech trends is corporate onboarding. Now, I'd never really thought about this, but they're talking about making it easier to set up your corporate bank accounts and wires and I guess other financial needs, similar to the way that you do for an individual. You just go online, you can set up an account online and get going and be on your way. Whereas corporates are still kind of, more, you have to go in the branch, fill out a lot of paperwork. I know I've had to do this for organizations, and it's definitely more of a pain and definitely more expensive.
Yeah, this was also something I had not given a lot of thought to. And you think about how many people who are like, oh, I hate my bank, but I just can't change my online bill pay situation. And I thought, gosh, you know, most people maybe have something like 5 to 10 monthly bills they're paying. A corporate entity is likely to have many more. They're not going to want to take the business risks of not getting money incoming, or maybe they won't want the money outgoing late as well, although that does vary by corporate temperament. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, wow, that is really something that this would be a great place for corporate clients to have more options and better service.
Yeah, it does seem to be a gap. And I like to see when fintechs or anybody really is addressing a pain point, something that's clearly nobody wants to do this, it's a hassle, and you know, corporates seem to be in that category for sure. So if somebody comes up with solutions, that'd be great.
It's also, I think, not a very sexy job. Again, I think the more boring stuff tends to be closer to us than we think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and there's money to be made, and that kind of makes it sexy. If you can steal away some corporate accounts.
Money is pretty sexy.
Money is sexy, I've been told, as I've been rejected. All right. Next, number 7 is connected cloud services. Now, this reminded me directly to IBM's acquisition of Red Hat software that we mentioned a few weeks ago, and how there's that kind of public and proprietary cloud services. And this is what they're talking about, that some services can migrate to something like with a lot of computing power available, like Azure or AWS. But because of regulatory and security concerns and privacy concerns of financial institutions, they can't always move quickly into that area. But some other things like customer service, they certainly can. HR, some of these things that other corporations are taking advantage of that financial institutions can do as well. And then down the line, with more of their back office operations as the security and the products improve. So here's an opportunity for you if you're looking to create a startup is creating those services. I'm sure you'd get acquired. Red Hat might be, has the IBM shrinking treasury behind them to make acquisitions. So it seems, it definitely makes sense. And certainly the justification for IBM's purchase of Red Hat is a positive outlook on these kinds of cloud services.
Mm-hmm. I do think that financial institutions generally will probably have to find the right balance and experiment in terms of what's cloud worthy and what's maybe cloud resistant, because it needs to be. It'll be something to watch.
I just wonder, I mean, if the CIA can have their servers on AWS in Virginia, I think it's the US one region. I've looked into this for my work. And if the CIA can do it, why can't a big bank host some?
Steve does not work for the CIA.
I do not work for the CIA.
He cannot confirm or deny that he works for the CIA.
Do we know exactly everything that the CIA keeps on those servers? Like, you know,
maybe it's just the passwords.
We don't, but I mean, even if it's just, you know, typical like HR data, that seems like it's
if you work for the federal government, you've already been right. The recipient of a major data hack, and certainly that was not AWS's fault. So I wouldn't necessarily.
Right.
We've already shown
it's
that
OPM,
HR and consumer data, nobody gives a shit.
Yeah,
you can edit that out.
They've already got my social security number like 3 times already. So what's another hack?
Yeah, if you're
going
a consumer or an employee, you have basically next to no rights. And when your data is compromised, nobody cares. That's old news. Now, intelligence secrets? That might be a different story.
Which leads me into number 8 trend for 2019 and beyond, data privacy framework. So, Monica, please go ahead and take it away.
Well, I'll just continue holding my breath for the federal government to take action on this.
California is leading the way, right?
Well, California has passed a law, and I consider that a good thing, but I consider it a good thing to have like a marker in the sand. I do not think that we should be legislating privacy at the state level, even if it is the most populous state that's starting it out. It's shameful and embarrassing to me that our federal government really can't figure out anything that they want to do in this space, and that we are all basically, unprotected little sheep with the wolves of data brokers, data thieves, and social media companies coming after us.
Do you think that any of the stuff in the news with Google and Facebook will maybe spur that change, or no?
I think it's definitely going to create more awareness, and I think ultimately something's going to happen. I don't think we're going to live in this kind of, anybody can do whatever they want with no penalty other than just their public reputation forever. But, you know, what does that timeline look like? Is it 5 years? Is it 10? I don't know.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. Yep. All right, so those are our big trends for, not ours, but actually this Business World article, let's give credit. The link will be in the show notes of trends that we see for the future. All right, so let's continue with my list theme for this week. And here are 4 major fintech trends in the self-directed IRA industry. So There's $28.2 trillion in dedicated retirement assets in the United States as of the end of 2017. Quiz time. What percent of that $28.2 trillion is invested in through an IRA account? Monica?
God, I even read this and I meant to write it down. I don't know. Tell us, John.
It's a very quizzy kind of number, actually.
I love it.
Tell us, John. Tell us.
All right. It's 33%.
Okay. So a third of it is in IRAs and roughly the other two-thirds are presumably in 401ks.
I guess 401ks, SEPs, KEOs, yes. All that okay. Other good stuff. Yeah.
But a SEP is an IRA.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right.
I have friends both named SEP and IRA. So there you go. I like it. Yeah. Hi, Seppy, if you're listening.
They probably don't spell their name all caps.
They don't. Yeah. It's all lowercase. Very, very artistic.
All right, so this is a big market, obviously, and one that fintechs appropriately have been looking into. And again, something that's kind of a pain point. People don't want to think about their retirement, and kind of it screams out for automation and kind of giving you clear information. So here's some of the things that are supposed to be helping with this going into the future. And one of those is a mobile account opening experience is number one. So being able to set up your account and just get started online or on your mobile device.
Seems very basic.
So yeah, I think this is already happening, right?
Yeah.
It's a low bar.
So congratulations, you identified a trend in the past.
Yeah, I know. Right. This made me think, I was like, oh, my self-directed IRA, how did I get it started? And to be fair, it was a number of years ago, I think I did it over the phone.
Ooh.
Whoa, yeah. How many buttons did you press to get to the right person?
Not that many, because I make sure to only do those kinds of investments with organizations that are going to talk to me real
that
fast.
That reminds me of dialing into the bank and then pressing one for your balance and two for your, I haven't done that in a while.
Like yeah. A decade?
A long time, at least. Yeah. Yeah. Bank by phone. I remember there was advertising for that. That was a promoted feature. We're so high tech, you can bank by phone.
But to be fair, I will say that opening an IRA is very easy. Transferring assets into an IRA is a very, very different thing.
100% agree. Absolutely.
Yes. And yeah. While certainly the technology exists to do it online, there's a lot of market timing risk in the mere act of doing it because you typically have to liquidate your asset out of what, you know, if it's in your 401k, you have to sell it out of that fund. Now you've got it in cash. You're not in control of when your 401k company decides to cut that check and disperse that check. And you're not in control of when you're receiving new self-directed IRA company actually decides to deposit it. And then you have to go back online and tell them that you'd like to put it in this asset. This is a huge flaw in our retirement
system. Last time I just wrote
a
check.
Because it was already in cash.
I did walk over to Charles Schwab and just throw a check at them.
But if you have something in your 401k,
you can't
keep it in that asset. It's so stupid. You have to cash it out.
Yeah, right, right.
Anyway, rant over.
Okay. Number two, an automatic savings application. Now, I think there's been lots of studies saying that if these things are automated and if employers set up your 401k as the default to start saving, that more people save. And they want to. Everybody wants to save. And
it's called behavioral economics.
Behavioral economics, exactly. Yeah, incentives and
nudges, all that.
Yep, that's all good stuff. So
but
this seems
also
like part
new?
Of that.
Like, yeah, again, I have been dollar cost averaging into my IRA for years as well.
Right.
Yeah, so this is applying it into apps, into the new fintech services. So, again, thanks for identifying a trend in the past and applying it into the future format, really. So number three is, they say, now this is an article in Forbes, is digital investments. So being able to invest in peer-to-peer lenders, if you so dare, cryptocurrencies, definitely long-term if you're going to do
that. Don't
do it. You're going to have to wait a while, sure. Digital asset exchanges, that type of thing through your IRA.
Yeah, so people listening may or may not know, but when you have a self-directed IRA, the scope of assets that you can put into that IRA are actually huge. You can put artwork. Your self-directed IRA can own a home. But what gets tricky is that you can only use funds inside that self-directed IRA to maintain and kind of caretake for any of those assets. So all of this is to say that self-directed IRAs give you a lot of flexibility, but, you know, once you start getting further and further away from kind of cookie cutter investments, you obviously need to be a much more sophisticated investor who really understands the long-term impacts, not just the taxable impacts of those choices. So, you know, you can put almost anything in a self-directed IRA, and you always could. It's just that now we have a bumper crop of new and exotic investments.
who's the leader in kind of a investment? Is it Betterment or Wealthfront?
I think it depends on how you define leader. I know that there's still their AUM is still dwarfed by Schwab and Fidelity and all the other big players.
Even as a pool, right?
Even as a pool, absolutely, yeah. So I'd say that, you know, Fidelity, Schwab, Prudential maybe are kind of the leaders in the space.
As I said, I did just do the Schwab thing. So
there you go.
Also, the people who are most likely to have significant market values in their IRAs, they are people who are either nearing retirement or in retirement, right? Because they've had a lifetime to build up those assets. And they are probably not the target audience.
I don't have that many gray hairs.
They're probably not the target audience right now of the Betterments and the wealth.
You know, I do
have
to say, and this may show my age, is, you know, I am comforted knowing that, well, first of all, Schwab has been around for a while, and they didn't get mentioned very much during the financial crisis. So I know they're not doing anything too crazy over there. And that there's branches around downtown San Francisco where I am. And if I want, if a question or a problem, I mean, it's such a hassle knowing, you know, you've seen that with other web services where they don't even have a phone number. You have to, I mean, chatting, if they have chat, that's very useful. But, you know,
I'm a banking account slut, and I have an account with Schwab, and I have for many years.
Yeah.
And the phone will ring twice before you're speaking to a live person when you call them.
Awesome.
I am a fan.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I've never called them yet, and I hope I don't have to.
So Schwab, for sponsorships, please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com.
Also, never change your policy of not charging additional foreign exchange fees when we pull out money internationally. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks, Chuck.
For our Euro investors and out there. All right, so our number four trend, we have to throw in a buzzword here.
Blockchain.
Great. Now, how they worked blockchain into self-directed IRAs is a bit of a stretch.
Nobody wants a list of three.
Yeah, here's the top three. No, top three is like a thing. But top 10 is the
top
ideal,
top three,
I think.
Is not a list.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. That's just a shopping note or something. Okay, got it. So they mentioned it's a very generic thing. So we're going to slap your hands, Forbes, on this part of the article about how it's trustworthy, secure, cost efficient. We're going to get into later about why all of this doesn't matter in our final bites. But so let's just throw blockchain out there, just as they did.
Yeah.
So and as an investment, I guess, for the cryptocurrencies. So that's number four of our trends. Thanks for listening.
That's a lot of numbers out there.
That's a lot of numbers.
We'll make sure to link these in the show notes.
Yep. All right. So let's get into some real hardcore regulatory. This is the real stuff kind of information.
Regulation, baby, absolutely. So the SEC announced sometime last week that they're launching a new strategic hub for innovation in financial technology. So we all know, of course, I think we discussed this a few months ago, that the OCC created a fintech sandbox so that, you know, fintechs can test stuff in a sandbox environment and not be subject to the regulations. And now the SEC is doing something kind of similar. They're basically creating a forum where people who are working in digital assets and also going back to that blockchain buzzword.
Please explain that blockchain thing again.
What
is
that? DLT thing. Yeah.
BLT,
yeah.
Did you say?
BLTs. BLT and mayo, yeah. Sounds delicious. But they've created this hub where basically players who are in the space can do things like they can speak with each other sort of as an industry. They can publicize information about SEC findings and rules and regulations as they apply to new financial innovation stuff. They can engage with the public by also having events and publicizing what they're working on, which I think is kind of cool.
Wow, transparency, clarity, communication.
Who knew?
It sounds all good. Until they come to arrest you.
Exactly. Until they come haul you out, yeah. This hub will act as a platform so that SEC staff can more easily disseminate information about new fintech stuff as well. So kind of I get the sense that people at the SEC and also the regional offices maybe don't have a lot of insight into what everyone's working on. So this can sort of bring some clarity and transparency to the process. So again, kind of a great thing. And the last one is that it'll also be a way for US-based fintechs to liaise with fintechs abroad as well.
I like the way you work liaise into that.
Oh,
you're so sophisticated,
liaise,
Steve.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's have a tete-a-tete later.
Yes.
I think this is a good thing, right? It's good when our regulators want to be at the forefront of what's happening and provide kind of reasonable ways for the industry to kind of ramp up and work with regulators. I'm excited to see what comes out.
Yeah, and just a sneak peek. I think in about 2 weeks or so, we're going to have somebody from a former FINRA prosecutor on the show. So maybe he'll give us some ideas about how they look at this up as well.
Calling
in from prison.
His
yes.
former, yeah.
He was a prosecutor, not prosecutor. Yes.
Oh, I thought you said prosecuted.
A former prosecutor, yeah, absolutely.
All right, yeah, thanks.
In other government news, somebody from USAID went around and contacted all these blockchain companies, and they were trying to study what the actual implementation of DLT projects was and what the success rate was of that as well. And he found that...
I'm going to guess 58%
close.
Success rate.
It's in the ballpark, yeah. So he contacted, I think, 43 or so ongoing, well-publicized blockchain projects. And he found, and I'm quoting here, that... he found a success rate of 0.00%.
I was just this close.
So close.
So close.
So of all the vendors and initiatives that he was in touch with, none of them were able to provide any sort of meaningful success for what they were doing. And he also found that vendors did not call back when he was asking them for evidence about what they were doing. So
picks and shovels, people. Picks and shovels. So this means when they say success rate, they mean where the DLT or blockchain project was actually operational, implemented, and doing, having the cost savings and benefits and security that they say that it was going to be, not just a proof of concept, the infamous proof of concept.
Right. So he found that, you know, he reviewed press releases, white papers, some of these articles online, some ICO
white
stuff.
Papers.
White papers.
Whoa,
I know, very fancy.
Yeah.
And virtually none of them could back up their claims, one, and also none of them could have an actual viable product that was using DLT or blockchain technology. So
I'm not too worked up about this. So first off, I mean, didn't everybody assume that there were major amounts of hype and overstatement in this space? I certainly did. And it is still early days. And I think regular listeners will know that I am not like falling all over myself because of Bitcoin and blockchain and whatnot. However, that said, it is an interesting technology and it just hasn't been around very long for people to have figured out how to integrate it into their operations and get the savings or the efficiencies that they wanted. So, you know, just because it's 0.0 right now out of 43, which is also
sample.
A small sample
yeah.
size, doesn't mean that that's the way it's going to stay.
Obviously didn't call the CryptoKitties people either. So
they didn't. He also noted kind of interestingly that he sees a proliferation of consulting companies helping you scale up or deploy your blockchain stuff.
Picks and shovels right
exactly.
there.
I will consult with you for $500 an hour.
One company called Fujitsu, I think, offers blockchain consulting services sort of on a fast track, £10,000. And again, none of their clients were able to show anything for their work.
So they'll come and evaluate whether it's appropriate or what benefits you can get out of blockchain implementations for your purposes. And if they just say there aren't any, it's a minimum £10,000.
Right.
But wait,
UK
currency
to get in.
I want to push back on, you know,
to get in the door.
These organizations don't have anything for their trouble because we don't know that, right? The whole point of innovation is you're going to try things and they're going to fail. But presumably somebody's learning something from these failures, you know, and hopefully figuring out, oh, well, if we do it this way or if we modify this, then we'll have a greater
Monica
chance of success.
Monica is in the unique position of defending blockchain today on the FinTech Newscast.
This is so weird. No, I have no problem with blockchain.
You're such a hodler.
Oh, God.
Holder,
yeah.
Just one final moment from this article here. They looked at how Monsanto is using blockchain, and they found a 95% failure rate for their blockchain effort.
95%. Well, that's 5% success. Wait, I thought you said 0% success rate.
Yeah. I'm guessing that that's 5% maybe is a POC or a POT or a proof of stake.
They couldn't even get it to work.
Yeah, works. It works on an abstract level, at least.
Mm. Well, a lot of things work in the abstract level. I have some bridges to sell you. And now it's time for our final bites. And actually, a special criminal episode of our final bite section, where we take a look at a story and, in this case, the prison sentence behind it.
Great. So if I can go first, my number is so exciting. It's $750,000.
Wow.
That is the fine levied on both DJ Khaled and Floyd Mayweather for promoting crappy ICOs and crypto schemes.
Well, if that's
on
a crime,
Instagram,
then the prisons are really full these days.
They
should, or they should
for
be.
Pay.
Promoting for pay, right. So they received, I think, between $150,000 to promote what was ultimately fraudulent crypto scams and ICOs. And the SEC came down to them and said, hey, DJ Khaled, you played yourself. Congratulations, fool. You played yourself. Here's a fine for several hundred thousand dollars. Same with Floyd Mayweather as well. So essentially, these guys were promoting all these, again, ICOs and crypto scams on Instagram and through their various social media channels. And the people who were behind them were also prosecuted and maybe even do some jail time. But I'm glad to see that these celebrities with no stake whatsoever in the space, no understanding, I'm assuming, of how blockchain works, as we previously discussed, we now have to pay the SEC $750,000.
So you have to know what you're promoting.
You should.
You should know what you're promoting. You should also disclose that you're promoting it, and you should be doing some due diligence about the plausible level of fraudulence related to what you're promoting.
Well, I'm sure now they'll be thinking about that a lot.
I am extremely supportive of the FEC and the SEC being really involved in what influencers and people with millions of social media followers do to get money from these platforms.
Well, these guys are just small potatoes compared to my criminal. My guy is Jared Rice, the CEO of a blockchain startup called Arise Bank. And my final bite is 120, which is the maximum potential number of years that he may be going to prison.
That seems like a lot.
He'll get now, two.
For a good behavior, yeah, maybe. And in a nice prison with a tennis court, maybe. Who knows?
White-collar crime.
The best kind to do if you're going to do it. Well, in keeping with my list theme for this episode, I'm going to list off the things that this guy has been charged with. This is Jared Rice, by the way. Don't hire him. All right. So he's accused of defrauding hundreds of investors out of $4 million, which he then fraudulently used to stay at fancy hotels, go out to nice restaurants, and buy, it says clothes, but I'm assuming this is fancy,
maybe
expensive
it was
clothes.
An ostrich leather bomber jacket.
Yeah, maybe.
Nice.
Nobody goes to jail for shopping at the Gap, you know. So this has got to be Louis Vuitton or things like that.
What's the jacket that Manafort wore?
That's what I'm talking about. My Paul Manafort reference.
Okay. Okay. The obligatory Paul Manafort reference. All right. He's also accused. This is a list, so I still have some ways to go. Of offering traditional bank services as insured. I mean, that's already two different things wrong right there. Because he didn't have a banking license and was not part of the FDIC, which actually provides the insurance. He also offered, and you know, if you're gonna do that, you're gonna offer your Visa branded debit cards and credit cards. I mean, that's a no-brainer. But he had no agreement with Visa at all. So, He also...
Was he just, like, punching out these, like, pseudo cards in his bedroom? Jesus!
I think you can order them online. Amazon. I think on Amazon you can order Visa cards. All right. I'm not done yet. He's got more. He also claimed that he raised $600 million in an ICO. We have to bring an ICO into this because that's the root of all evil, apparently. So he has something called an Arise coin, and the blockchain for that, he said, was going to be this self-directed, I have that from the IRA article, this self-governing blockchain that will run the bank and do that kind of thing. So it'll be like the world's first decentralized financial institution. So that's what he was selling, and that's I guess that's how he got the money from the investors. But he claimed to have raised $600 million. He only stole $4 million from these people. And he's so he was indicted on 3 counts of securities fraud and 3 counts of wire fraud. The SEC also sued him for fraud and issuing unregistered securities in January of this year. So this guy kept going even after the SEC sued him for related to this ICO. And the ICO was already illegal. And then what he did with the ICO was illegal, and he lied about the money he raised with that. So in other words, just be careful with who you're investing your money with and do a little background check. Because this guy did everything under the sun wrong. Yeah. But you might be investing with somebody that's just doing one of these things wrong, but it's still going to bring down the whole house, right?
Oh, my God.
So that's my final buy. And I thought it was really interesting how much he could get away with and just keep going and going, you know, throughout all of 2018. And now he gets to spend Christmas in jail.
It's impressive how much trouble you can get yourself into with $4 million of runway.
Yeah.
He illegally really, gotten runway.
He really extended his runway to take up the startup metaphor.
Yeah.
And just for context here, I see that Madoff was sentenced to 150 years. This guy got 120. And Madoff stole billions of dollars, so...
I don't know. It's the quality, Steve. It's the quality, not the quantity.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. This guy was a first-class criminal for sure.
Oh, man.
This guy's only... Okay, on top of this, this guy's only 30 years old. So he'll get out potentially when he's 150 years old.
He's not going to get...
At the worst.
Maybe they're not going to put him away that long.
By 40?
They won't.
No.
I like that. I like these numbers that are beyond lifetime sentences. You get 3 life sentences. Well, in this case, it's close to
it. It's very motivating to make a plea when you're looking at a 120-year sentence.
Yeah, we only wanted to get 80 out of him, so that's my...
If we get 20, I'll be...
You'll be happy?
I'll buy you lunch.
All right. I'm looking forward to that. Jared Rice. And I'm going to have arroz con pollo. No. Oh. All right, never mind.
And now it's my turn. And for my final bite, I am talking about something that has been in the headlines on and off for the last few months, but it's still pretty impressive in terms of lack of proper running of a bank. So the number itself is $230 billion. And this is the amount of money that was laundered primarily through Russian dirty money, but not exclusively. And this staggering amount of money was laundered through a tiny Estonian branch of Danske Bank. And this has really rocked the world of Danish banking, that's for sure. So Danske Bank, you know, is widely had been widely considered to be one of the prides of Danish industry. Anyway, this all comes about because one of the employees who works in the Estonian branch decides to kind of confirm that an LLC that's registered in Britain, what they've said in terms of their net assets of $0 does not jive with the fact that there's £1 million coming in and out of this account on a daily basis. So he spends £1 online to look up months later to see if this LLC has revised its statements, and they hadn't. And that's when he starts really going on a whistleblowing spree inside Danske Bank.
So
and this
do
all
they respond
comes down.
Like they should, or do they kind of quiet him down like so many whistleblowers that we hear about where nobody wants to listen to them, right?
What do you think?
Well, it's come out now, so eventually, I guess somebody listened.
But the first reaction was, you know, oh, well, we'll look into it.
You're a low-grade guy. You don't know what you're talking about.
No, they don't talk down to him. They say, oh, you know, we'll look into it. We'll take care of it. But then he starts to realize that this is actually, it's not just this one account. It's not just LLC Lantana Road. It's dozens of accounts. And then ultimately it turns out to be almost the entire banking portfolio of this Estonian branch.
So this is how you go from $1 million transactions kind of back and forth to $200 billion. It's multiple entities doing the same kind of play.
Correct. So it turns out basically almost all of the money in this bank was dirty.
Yeah, who was it that was...
It's primarily Russian money. And keep in mind, this money is so dirty that the Russians who were opening accounts with this branch, they were on a not-to-be-banked list put out by the Russians.
Wait, by the Russians.
Correct. So they could not actually get banking services in Russia, which is part of the reason they were going to
Estonia.
Which apparently Estonia actually has a very robust anti-money laundering system, and they're widely considered to have one of the least corrupt banking systems. But all of their documentation is written in Estonian, and Danske Bank just really never bothered to get it translated and read their warnings.
Looks good to me.
No one reads Estonian. Yeah.
But the boxes are checked.
But the money was not just Russian money at all, because you know what? Dirty money knows no borders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yo, we got a sucker here. We're going to funnel everything through there. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds about right. All right. Thanks to that that banker, first of all, for being so persistent. And for all you whistleblowers out there, you have to be persistent. Nobody listens to you the first time, unless you're the CEO or something like that. But usually the CEO is the one that's doing all the crimes anyway, so... It's kind of counter the incentives there. All right, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions, comments, or would like to see any topics discussed, please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. And thanks again for listening.
Thanks for joining.
Bye for now.